Tonight I find myself here in a guest house in the city of Salisbury. The first day of my trip is now completed, and all in all I must say I am quite satisfied. The expedition began this morning, almost an hour later than I had planned. I suppose I was very conscious of the fact that once I had departed, Darlington Hall would stand empty for probably the first time this century. Perhaps for the first time since the day it was built. It was an odd feeling, and perhaps accounts for why I delayed my departure so long, checking one last time that all was in order. For the first 20 minutes or so of motoring, I cannot say I was seized by any excitement or anticipation at all. But then, eventually, the surroundings grew unrecognizable, and I knew I had gone beyond all previous boundaries. I have heard people describe the moment when setting sail in a ship that one finally loses sight of the land. I imagine the experience of unease mixed with exhilaration is very similar to what I felt in the Ford as the surroundings grew strange around me. This occurred just after I took a turning and found myself on a road curving around the edge of a hill. The feeling swept over me that I had truly left Darlington Hall behind. And I must confess, I did feel a slight sense of alarm. Even when I had assured myself I was on the right road, I felt compelled to stop the car a moment to take stock, as it were. I decided to step out and stretch my legs a little. I believe I had walked a little way along the roadside when I heard a voice behind me. Further up the road, I could see the start of a footpath which disappeared steeply up into the thickets. Sitting on the large stone that marked this spot was a thin, white-haired man in a cloth cap smoking his pipe. For a moment I took him for a vagrant, but then I saw he was just some local fellow enjoying the fresh air and summer sunshine. "Just wondering, sir," he said as I approached, "how fit your legs were." "I beg your pardon?" The fellow gestured up the footpath. "You gotta have a good pair of legs and a good pair of lungs to go up there. There's a nice little spot up there, a bench and everything. And you won't get a better view anywhere in the whole of England." I glanced up the path, which did look steep and rather rough. "I'm telling you, sir, you'll be sorry if you don't take a walk up there, and you never know. A couple more years and it might be too late." He gave a rather vulgar laugh. "Better go on up there while you still can." It occurs to me now that the man might just possibly have meant this as a bantering remark. But this morning I must say I found it quite offensive, and it may well have been the urge to demonstrate just how foolish his insinuation had been that caused me to set off up the footpath. In any case, I'm very glad I did so. Certainly it was quite a strenuous walk, the path rising in zigzags up the hillside for 100 yards or so. I then reached a small clearing, undoubtedly the spot the man had referred to. Here one was met by a most marvellous view over miles of the surrounding countryside. I believe it was then that I felt the first healthy flush of anticipation for the many interesting experiences I know these days ahead hold in store for me. This evening, I find myself settled here in this comfortable guest house in a street not far from the centre of Salisbury. The landlady appears to regard me as a rather grand visitor on account of Mr. Faraday's Ford and the high quality of my suit. This afternoon, when I entered my address in her register as Darlington Hall, I could see her look at me with some trepidation. In the quiet of this room, I find that what remains with me from this first day's travel is that marvellous view encountered this morning of the rolling English countryside. The English landscape, at its finest, possesses a quality that the landscapes of other nations invariably fail to possess. This quality is probably best summed up by the term greatness. And yet what precisely is this greatness? If I were forced to hazard a guess, I would say that it is the very lack of obvious drama or spectacle that sets the beauty of our land apart. It is as though the land knows of its own beauty, of its own greatness, and feels no need to shout it. The whole question is very akin to the question that has caused much debate in our profession over the years. What is a great butler? How often have you known it for the butler who is on everyone's lips one day as the greatest of his generation to be proved demonstrably within a few years to have been nothing of the sort? The object of this sort of servants' hall talk is invariably some butler who has come to the fore quite suddenly through having been appointed by a prominent house, and who has perhaps managed to pull off two or three large occasions with some success, and what has happened before a few years have passed. This same invincible figure has been held responsible for some blunder, leaves the house where he came to fame, and is never heard of again. Meanwhile, these same gossipers will have found yet some other newcomer about whom to enthuse. But let me return to the question, what is a great butler? It does seem to me that the factor which distinguishes them from those butlers who are merely extremely competent is most closely captured by this word, dignity. Now, while I would accept that the majority of butlers may well discover ultimately that they do not have the capacity for it, I believe strongly that this dignity is something one can meaningfully strive for throughout one's career. It is my firm conviction that at the peak of his career at Loughborough House, my father was the embodiment of dignity. I realize that if one looks at the matter objectively, one has to concede my father lacked various attributes one may normally expect in a great butler. Furthermore, it must be remembered that my father was a butler of an earlier generation, who began his career at a time when such attributes were not considered proper, let alone desirable in a butler. And I would maintain that for all his limited command of English and his limited general knowledge, he not only knew all there was to know about how to run a house, he did, in his prime, come to acquire dignity in keeping with his position. Now, if I try to describe to you what I believe made my father thus distinguished, I may in this way convey my idea of what dignity is. I should explain here that I am one of two brothers, and that my elder brother, Leonard, was killed during the Southern African War while I was still a boy. Naturally, my father would have felt this loss keenly, but to make matters worse, the notion that his son gave his life gloriously for king and country was sullied by the fact that my brother had perished needlessly in a particularly infamous manoeuvre. There had been calls for the removal, even the court-martialing of the general concerned, but the army had defended the latter, and he had been allowed to complete the campaign. At the close of the Southern African conflict, this same general had entered business, dealing in shipments from Southern Africa. Some 10 years after the conflict, my father was called into Mr. John Silvers's study to be told that this very same personage was due to visit for a number of days to attend a house party, during which my father's employer hoped to lay the foundations of a lucrative business transaction. Mr. Silvers had remembered the significance the visit would have for my father, and had called him in to offer him the option of taking several days' leave for the duration of the general's stay. My father's feelings towards the general were, naturally, those of utmost loathing, but he realized, too, that his employer's present business aspirations hung on the smooth running of the house party. My father thus replied to the effect that while he was most grateful that his feelings had been taken into account, Mr. Silvers could be assured that service would be provided to the usual standards. So well did my father hide his feelings that on his departure, the general had actually complimented Mr. John Silvers on the excellence of his butler and had left an unusually large tip in appreciation, which my father, without hesitation, asked his employer to donate to a charity. And let me now posit this. Dignity has to do crucially with a butler's ability not to abandon the professional being he inhabits. Lesser butlers will abandon their professional being for the private one at the least provocation. The great butlers are great by virtue of their ability to inhabit their professional role to the utmost. they wear their professionalism as a decent gentleman will wear his suit. He will discard it when, and only when, he wills to do so, and this will invariably be when he is entirely alone. It is, as I say, a matter of dignity. In these quiet moments, I find myself going over in my mind again passages from Miss Kenton's letter. Oh, incidentally, I should, before now, have explained myself as regards my referring to Miss Kenton. Miss Kenton is, properly speaking, Mrs. Benn, and has been for 20 years. However, because I knew her at close quarters only during her maiden years, and have not seen her once since she went to the West Country to become Mrs. Benn, you will perhaps excuse my impropriety in referring to her as I knew her. Of course, her letter has given me extra cause to continue thinking of her as Miss Kenton, since it would seem that her marriage is finally come to an end. The letter does not make specific the details of the matter, but Miss Kenton states that she has taken the step of moving out of Mr. Benn's house in Helston, and is presently lodging with an acquaintance in the nearby village of Little Compton. At this very moment, no doubt, she is pondering with regret decisions made in the far-off past that have now left her, deep in middle age, so alone and desolate. And it is easy to see how, in such a frame of mind, the thought of returning to Darlington Hall would be a great comfort to her. Admittedly, she does not at any point in her letter state explicitly her desire to return, but that is the unmistakable message conveyed by the general nuance of many of the passages. Her letter does at times reveal a certain despair over her present situation, a fact that is rather concerning. She writes, "The rest of my life stretches out as an emptiness before me." For the most part, though, as I have said, the tone is one of nostalgia. At one point, for instance, she writes, "I was so fond of that view from the second floor bedrooms overlooking the lawn with the downs visible in the distance. Is it still like that? I will confess to you now I used to waste many precious minutes standing at one of those windows just enchanted by it." Then she goes on to add, "If this is a painful memory, forgive me, but I will never forget that time we both watched your father walking back and forth in front of the summer house, looking down at the ground as though he hoped to find some precious jewel he had dropped there." It is something of a revelation that this memory from over 30 years ago should have remained with Miss Kenton as it has done with me. I can recall distinctly seeing a series of orange shafts from the sunset breaking the gloom of the corridor where each bedroom door stood ajar. As I made my way past those bedrooms, I had seen Miss Kenton's figure silhouetted against a window turn and call softly, "Mr. Stevens, if you have a moment..." As I entered, Miss Kenton had turned back to the window. To the right of our view, the lawn sloped up a gentle embankment to where the summer house stood, and it was there my father's figure could be seen, pacing slowly with an air of preoccupation. Indeed, as Miss Kenton puts it so well, as though he hoped to find some precious jewel he had dropped there. There are some very pertinent reasons why this memory has remained with me. Moreover, now that I come to think of it, it is perhaps not so surprising that it should also have made a deep impression on Miss Kenton, given certain aspects of her relationship with my father during her early days at Darlington Hall.